You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, December 19th, 2016. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Monday, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Ben Mankiewicz from Turner Classic Movies and the Young Turks. We're talking about why modern progressive politics have failed. Jerry Brown, California, resistance and leadership. And has television dumbed us down to this point? It's a broad conversation. I just recorded it in the last 40 minutes, so I already know how good it is. No suspense on our end. You'll get to enjoy it in a few. Plus, is this the end of the West? Germany's former foreign minister and Green Party leader Joschka Fischer says yes. Interesting critique of the collapse of modern European security architecture. North Carolina's Republicans' coup passes. And John Kasich signs very dangerous limitation on access to women's reproductive rights. He vetoed the more extreme one. Signed the quote-unquote less extreme one to set up that incredibly dangerous precedent and win. Governor Paul LePage, the humorless Donald Trump, maneuvering in Maine against the minimum wage increase. States matter. They are the incubators of extremism versus progress. Maybe we can change all of that. Rex Tillerson helped manage a company for Russian oil in the Bahamas as Trump's foreign policy of hands-off neo-mercantile resource extraction becomes more and more clear by the day. And what's the part of Russia's foreign policy maneuvering that actually matters? Something that actually has global consequences, and it is the facilitation of global far-right politics. Humanitarian catastrophe in Aleppo. Get to that. And town in Montana getting targeted, Jewish families targeted for removal by white supremacists. All of this as we begin to fight very old and very ancient battles in Donald Trump's America on today's Majority Report. Fresh Two Dope Boys dropping tomorrow. We talk about Google in Cuba, Silicon Valley and human rights, authoritarian regimes, and opening and closing, and why the internet is a utility. Also, Amazon and the end of work. If you haven't already, subscribe to Two Dope Boys and a podcast. Let me just say up top that Christmas is fast approaching. And stores everywhere are going to be packed with last-minute holiday shoppers. But luckily, you don't have to battle crowds to get the perfect gift. Instead, choose a gift from Shari's Berries. Shari's Berries offer a variety of juicy, fresh berries dipped in your choice of chocolatey goodness and topped with decorative swirls, chocolate chips, or chopped nuts. We've talked about the Shari's Berries box, which literally disappeared within moments in the office. I mean, didn't last very long. Sam snagged most of it to take to his family. I'm sure they were grateful for that. I was addicted to the chocolate-covered strawberries. I always say that the chocolate was amazing, very, very tasty, but the strawberry was fresh. I don't usually go for things like that because I usually find the fruit kind of mealy and off, but that strawberry was perfect. The chocolate was perfect. Everybody just basically murdered this box. It's really, really tasty. Plus, they've added some amazing new seasonal treats just in time for the holidays, like the handmade snowman brownie pops, which are absolutely adorable. Sherry's Berries has something for everyone and every taste. Now you can get 6 freshly dipped strawberries from Sherry's Berries starting at just $19.99 plus shipping. That's an over 30% savings. Or double the berries for just 10 more. Just visit berries, berries.com. Click on the microphone in the top right-hand corner and type in the code Majority Report. With Christmas right around the corner, there's only one way to get this amazing deal with Sherry's Berries starting at $19.99 and help support our show. Go to berries.com, click on the microphone, type in Majority Report to order them today. Do you remember how there was this theory about how Hillary Clinton and Henry Kissinger were joined at the hip? And I found Hillary Clinton's appreciation of Henry Kissinger to be pretty repulsive, as did Bernie Sanders. He pointed that out in the presidential debate and talked about Henry Kissinger's career, which included supporting coups in Chile, not to mention other sort of Latin American death squads, a questionable, horrible role in Cyprus, and of course the sort of beginnings of his career in escalating the illegal war in Vietnam, firebombing Laos and Cambodia. I mean, truly a person who, by almost any objective measure I could think of, is a war criminal. But apparently still a very respected member of the American society and Washington establishment. I actually read Henry Kissinger's book on China. It's very well written and very fascinating. The texture and the depth start to sort of diminish a bit when he talks about his personal role in the dealings with China. But it is a fascinating book. But look, there was this notion that he was somehow loyal to Hillary Clinton or really wanted her, and that was somehow this indictment of her over Donald Trump, was also utterly delusional and ludicrous. After all, Henry Kissinger is a Republican, more than happy to work with any aspect of power. And here he is over the weekend. He was on Face the Nation with John Dickerson. And it belies a couple of narratives, because there's also the other narrative is, you know, well, whatever else you say about Henry Kissinger, he certainly is a serious person. And of course, no serious foreign policy strategist and thinker who cares with profound commitment about America's place in the world, regardless of the humanitarian toll, would really be sympathetic to Donald Trump, right? Well, maybe not so right. Let's check out Henry Kissinger here.
What advice would you give incoming President Trump about advisors, about being the president in these times?
One of the hardest things for a president is to distinguish the routine issues that come through from the essential issues that affect the long term, and not to let himself get sucked into the battles of the bureaucracy for marginal issues and to keep them focused and to keep his mind clear on what the fundamental things are that he has to accomplish.
Yeah. Dr. Kissinger,
Well, I mean, obviously Vanity Fair reviewing my restaurant, pretty essential, right? Is that marginal, Henry? Because I don't think so. I think it's demarginal because it was unpresidentiated that they would write that about me. But there's Henry Kissinger basically saying, I'm willing to play ball in the Trump era, and here's a bunch of sort of pseudo-intellectual pablum that you will eat up, and he might be a great president. He's just sitting there like an ancient old evil wizard, like kind of there being like, you know, John, it really is amazing that I have taken this accent and a slightly above average intellect, and I have turned it into a successful global criminal career that has spanned decades, really. Go ahead. Give them a kiss. It's through the trousers. It's really just kind of repulsive. I mean, and it's not as if these things are not like
omni-available. I mean, all of these people fell in love with Christopher Hitchens when he became like an atheist warmonger and actually produced some of the worst writing in his career. And I don't just mean that ideologically. I mean literally, qualitatively, his writing seriously diminished as he moved to the right. They loved that guy. He wrote the book, not the best book on Kissinger, but a book that you could certainly, you know, blow.
It's one of the easiest consumable.
You could blow through it in half of a plane ride, okay? And it's all pretty much laid out there. I remember Christopher Hitchens was interviewed by, I believe it was Christopher Lydon years ago, and I remember there was this great moment in the interview where they were talking about Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and Hitchens goes, Mr. Lydon, can we move to other parts of the world because there's other crimes to discuss? And Lydon goes, oh, we'll get there. There's a whole world to lay to waste, which is a great summary of that legacy. There's no way to transition this, so I'm just going to get to it. We've been drinking Hint water in the office. We love it. There's been fights over it. It's been a big hit. I have no doubt that Matt has probably stolen some, stuffed them in his backpack. But it's great because I'm very happy to see Matt drinking water. And did you know that you should drink 8 glasses of water a day? But who really does? Coffee, soda, energy drinks. But who really does? Coffee, soda, energy drinks. Why don't you drink more water? Because it's bland and you want something that tastes good. Here's the solution. Drink Hint water instead. Water can be boring, and that's why you should try Hint water. Hint water was started by Kara Golden a few years ago after having her fourth child. She was overweight, had terrible acne, and felt overall awful. She was drinking 10 diet sodas a day. Man, that is really bad for you. Instead of drinking water. Because water is boring. But what other options? You're boring! But what other options out there are there? Juices full of calories and no-calorie drinks are garbage. That's why she started Hint water. Hint is pure water infused with the taste of fresh fruit. With Hint, drinking water isn't boring, and they have the flavors to suit any palate. Watermelon, peach, mango, grapefruit, and many more. No sugar, no chemicals, just great-tasting, all-natural. Fruit-flavored water. Both Health and Self magazine have named Hint water the best-flavored water, and they know how important drinking plenty of water is to your health. Plus, you don't have to carry a heavy case of water from the store. You can have it delivered right to your doorstep. And right now, you can get a single variety pack shipped directly to your door, including three bottles each of Hint's 4 most popular flavors, pineapple, which is my favorite, watermelon, crisp apple, and blackberry, normally for $24 for only $15 at drinkhint.com/majority. That's drink, H-I-N-T. .com/majority. drinkhint.com/majority. And once you're fully hydrated and healthy, you can attend to your small business. And that's why I have to ask you, are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job in all top job sites, and now you can. And of course, I'm talking about the great ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter has 9 million resumes you can search through on their database. You can add multiple people to your account to make it the most efficient for your team to find the best hire. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job up to 100 plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. ZipRecruiter is a search engine for finding and posting jobs, finding candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, hire the right person fast. If you have any issue, ZipRecruiter's friendly and human, very, very important, support staff is ready to help. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 1 million businesses. As featured on Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, Time Magazine, The New York Times, TechCrunch, and CBS, ZipRecruiter's website also shows trending careers in fields, cities, and searches. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. And one more time, try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. We will be back. And during this break, we've been talking a lot about the 1990s. I want to play one of the best things that ever happened in the 1990s. And after you hear some of that, We will be back with my conversation with the great Ben Mankiewicz from Turner Classic Movies and The Young Turks on The Majority Report. Tell me who flop, who cop the blue drop, who jewels got pop, who mostly go she down to the blue drop. The same old pimp, mace, you know ain't nothing changed but my limp. Can't stop till I see my name on a blimp. Guarantee me and tells full of love or luck. You don't believe in Harlem World, double up. We don't play around, it's a bet, lay it down. Niggas didn't know me 91, bet they know me now. I'm the young Harlem with the goldie sound. Can't no P&D, hold me down. Cooler, school me to the game, now I know my duty. Stay humble, stay low, blow like Hootie. True pimp, spin no dough on the booty. Yeah, there go Mace, there go your cutie.
See me die and see me fly. I call all the shots, rip all the spots, rock all the rocks, top all the drops. I know you're thinking now when all the ball stops. You never home, gotta call me on the yacht. 10 years from now, we'll still be on top. Yo, I thought I told you that we won't stop. Now, what you gonna do with a crew that got money much longer than yours? And a team much stronger than yours. Violate me, this a B.O.J. day. We don't play, mess around, be on your way. Cause it ain't enough time here, ain't enough lime here. You to shine here, deal with many women, but treat down fair. And I'm bigger than the city lights down in Times Square. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
DEA, federal agents mad cause I'm flagrant. Tap myself and the phone in the basement. My team supreme, stay clean. Miracle dream, I'll be that. Catch a seat at all events bent. Girls on shoulders, playboy, I told ya. Me and Mike to me, lose too much, I lose too much.
Welcome back to The Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Ben Mankiewicz from Turner Classic Movies and The Young Turks. He's a host on both. Ben, how you doing, man?
I'm good, Michael. How are you? Good morning.
I'm doing pretty good.
Or afternoon.
Yeah.
Morning where I am.
No, it's still morning here. Are you
morning in the breakaway Republic of California.
In the yeah, it might not be a bad idea. Maybe there could be some type of like Pakistan used to have Bangladesh and it used to make absolutely no sense. Before it broke away. Maybe we could do that with New York and Cali. We could just have some type of direct. I mean, we already kind of do. People fly back and forth all the time.
Although, well, you remember when Rick Perry would, you know, talked about, you know, Texas and many others, but I associated with Rick Perry. But when Perry would talk about Texas, you know, independence and, you know, because of Obamacare, and we'd laugh at them.
right.
Point our fingers and mock. And now I'm like, you know, California's the fifth or sixth biggest economy in the world. We're fine.
Okay? Yeah.
Like, we go. Yeah, we're good. Yeah.
You know, the only thing that ever worried me about that kind of talk was I was sort of like, the kind of like WMD programs and like state sponsored terrorism from some type of like Southern American republic would be terrifying.
Yeah, no. Look, the whole thing's terrifying, and I don't want California to go anywhere.
Yeah,
I like it here. I maintain my love of country, but Barney Frank has that great quote that I'll butcher. You know, everybody's always complaining about politicians, but the electorate's no prize either. It's a great line.
It is a great line.
And, you know, it turns out, yeah, I mean, you know, we were, you know, I believed the hype for years and years about how special we were, and we're not.
No.
We're like, in a non-shocking development, we're like the rest of the planet.
Yeah, no, we're definitely not. I mean,
we're a mixed bag.
Everybody is special and not special in their own ways, Ben.
That's right.
And actually, we'll get to And
you're going to be a great parent, Michael.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. We'll see. Easier in word than in practice, man. I admire parents, but that's a whole other thing, because I think that I don't know if my patience is refined there yet. But I do want – we're going to get to North Carolina in a second, but since we're actually touching on this California theme, it is interesting because short of this notion of breaking away, obviously, which is a whole other thing, there we are in the ironic position where progressive politics and science in some respects and any type of kind of forward momentum in politics is going to need to be preserved in states. And that sort of runs the gamut, whether it's dealing with an issue like immigrants' rights, maintaining some advancements in healthcare access. And in this case, in California's case, Jerry Brown is obviously someone who I think actually in some ways has a mixed record on the environment, but he certainly is a leader on the climate crisis and on new energy platforms and someone who really gets it. And last week, he was speaking at the American Geophysical Union, which is a place that Rick Perry will address next week. Just kidding. And he basically said, he had this to say, if basically the federal government stops monitoring the effects of climate change. Let's take a listen to this, Ben, and then I want your reaction.
Now, some people say that they're going to turn off the satellites that are monitoring the climate, low Earth phenomena, the Landsat, and all the various measuring satellites that we have. Well, I remember back in 1978, I proposed a Landsat satellite for California. They called me Governor Moonbeam because of that. I didn't get that moniker for nothing. And if Trump turns off the satellites, California will launch its own damn satellite. We're going to collect that data.
Ben.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, I mean, you know, I like it because of the spirit more than anything. You know, I don't, I mean, great, good. We should, we can launch the satellites. I can, you know, I can take an increase in my California taxes that will be offset by the apparent massive reduction I'm about to get federal taxes.
Right.
I like it because of the spirit. Earlier in that speech, he said, we've got the scientists, we've got the lawyers, we're ready to fight, we're ready to defend.
Right.
And that to me is that's the spirit, you know, the specifics of it. I have no idea. What does it cost? $2,000 to launch a satellite? I mean, I have no idea. You know, it's one of those things that costs tens of millions of dollars, and I don't know why or how or who does it. But I like that I like that Jerry Brown won't take losing lying down, which sets him apart among Democrats and always has.
Yeah, I mean, and there's another kind, there's a couple of interesting things there, too, to also tease apart. One thing is there's an interesting similarity between Jerry Brown and Donald Trump, which is that they both clearly speak with very sort of lightly written speeches, to say the least. Like, he's obviously ad-libbing there to some extent, and except in contrast to Trump, he's a brilliant guy saying relevant things versus sort of like, you know, a nightclub act meets a neo-fascist. But, you know, the other thing, too, that I think I liked that you pointed out is there's sort of like two grids to this response to the Trump age. And one grid, one axis is having a really unequivocal progressive message, which I think is really important. And I think that you also think is important, which really sort of sets the clear markers down and says, you know, this is what we believe, this is what we want on taxes, this is what we want on the environment. Jerry Brown is not necessarily, I mean, he's certainly not nearly as left-wing as Bernie Sanders. He's more actually from the centrist ring of the party. But it's a whole other metric, which is just speaking plainly and unapologetically. And also even taking, like, he took the Governor Moonbeam thing and is like, yeah, they made a joke about it. But actually, I was right. I was just ahead of the curve. And we'll do it again. Screw you.
I thought Jerry Brown, I mean, yes, you know, it turned out when he became governor and after being mayor of Oakland that he was more in the centrist wing of the party in ways. But he is a thinker
right.
in the party, always has been, even if it wasn't ever part of some other thing that people were thinking about.
Right.
You know, even a few signs, it seemed like he was alone thinking by himself. But, you know, he appeared in 92 to be more progressive than Bill Clinton. And then,
yep.
you know, and then he governed a state, first a city in crisis and then a state in crisis. And, you know, and so the difficulties of doing the job made him, mainstreamed him a little bit. And that is something that all progressives are going to have to accept in the country we live in. Right. And the kind of government we have, even if we're able to successfully return to power. I think you're right. He's hard to pigeonhole
because right.
he's a complicated, interesting guy. He in some of that language that he used there about we're ready to fight, we're ready to defend, we got the lawyers. So just being there's the specificity of it, like, hey, we got the lawyers,
right?
Which I loved. We have the scientists, we got the lawyers. Like they're part of this fight,
right?
And it reminded me of a thing that really after today is going to seem even more a pathetic thing to say than it already sounds like right now. Which is that we're never going to know what I thought might happen with Hillary. I supported Bernie in the primary, but I switched very quickly to Hillary and was not excited about it, but thought, you know, we're in this terrible situation where there's no choice here.
I was about as excited for Hillary as I would be for a house wine at a suburban Indian restaurant, but I did support her. Yeah.
Right. Totally.
Yeah.
The nice touch with suburban.
That's yeah.
right. Because, you know, a metropolitan Indian restaurant, probably pretty good.
No, probably also pretty terrible. Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Right. But I mean, I got a better
wine at any Indian restaurant.
I've never used in my life until today. but like I thought where Hillary would unquestionably be better than, President Obama, was that we always progressives always underestimated her. I thought her ability to fight. She liked fighting. They were good at fighting, and the nuttiness of the opposition was going to cause her to fight. I hoped this was, you know, who knows? This was my scenario. But rather than simply follow the progressive line that she would sell out to her corporate donors and corporate interests, and that would be that. I thought she's going to surprise you by being a bit of a warrior. Yeah, she won't fight her fighting spirit won't exist on the terms that you want it to, but she will fight in a way that he never did, and not now. Obviously, we'll never know. And I hear some of that in Jerry Brown. Always have.
Yeah, and Jerry. Well, actually, that's the before we get off of Jerry Brown, I'm actually curious because one of the things that I learned so much from every time we talk, Ben, is you have a very historical perspective on this stuff, and I'm wondering, like. Not trying to say you're old. I'm just saying you have a historical view, buddy. But
okay,
what? Yeah, yeah. Excuse me. That was a little. That was kind of a house wine at a suburban Indian restaurant comment right there. But what makes a guy like? And I know it's some of it is definitely not just generational because there's plenty of other kind of baby boomer politicians that are not nearly as intellectually rigorous or as interesting as Jerry Brown. But it does seem that. You know, the quality of these individuals is not improving. I mean, there's people here and there, and I think President Obama on a personal level is an impressive person. And then obviously, you know, I have a lot of respect, a tremendous amount of respect for Bernie Sanders. But there does seem something very particular about Jerry Brown as an intellect, as a leader, as an iconoclast, where it's like, it just is not something that exists in contemporary American life. Maybe it didn't exist when he first came on the scene either, but what are we missing there with cultivating leaders like that?
I mean, I don't want to sound too, well, I mean, I'm going to sound like my father, who knew more about this than anybody, ever, you know, he was Bobby Kennedy's press secretary, ran George McGovern's campaign,
right.
A couple of progressive guys. At the time they were working, but look at like take Bobby, for example, Bobby had a legitimate transformation.
Right.
I mean, became a different person.
Right.
That doesn't happen. That is a rare instance where we take someone who was, you know, a hardline guy on a lot of issues and certainly on everything having to do with communism. And then his brother got murdered and he thought, one, did I cause that? Right. Did my stance with either the mafia or on Cuba, did I play a role in what just happened? But also just a violent moment in his life made him reflect and made him look at other people in a different way and changed his entire to oversimplify what happened to him massively because we don't have time. But both of those guys were completely eager to buck the establishment, didn't care, didn't think of it in those terms. George McGovern flew, I don't know, I'm going to make up the number, either 45 or 75 bombing missions over Germany.
Nailed it.
In World War II, right? And when... And when this was the beginning of hammering Democrats as doves and soft, and if we let elect Democrats, the Soviet Union will dominate the world. And here's a guy who was braver than Richard Nixon ever was.
Right.
Right. And he wouldn't let Gary Hart, wouldn't let my father, wouldn't let the campaign surrogates, of which I think McGovern had six, talk about it.
Right.
He's like, no, that's what everybody did. That's what you did. That was an obligation. I mean, that was an honor and an obligation, and that's what you did. And as an American, we don't talk about it.
Wow.
So what my father would say in answer to your question is television, which was starting to creep in during that era, hurt McGovern worse than it would have hurt Bobby. But television has ruined it. And just you look at who we have. I mean, this is a thing I say on the Young Turks a lot, and I'm not even totally kidding. Like, you look at the hair of politicians now, right? Like, these guys all look like, blah, who was the guy? They all look like Ben Nelson from Nebraska.
Oh,
right?
Man, the helmet.
Right. Right.
That was terrifying. Like, how does it even grow genetically? I mean, people got to go on Google and look up Ben Nelson. That is a very specific reference. We should maybe throw an image up if we can, because that was terrifying.
And Roy Blunt is the only person maybe in Ben Nelson's league. Ben Nelson wins, but
Roy
I'm saying
Blunt, yep.
that these guys all look like Wichita local anchors. And by the way, Wichita or San Francisco, local anchors look largely the same everywhere.
And more Wichita than San Francisco. Let's be real. Yeah, look at that.
Anchors, I mean, there's a homogeny to these guys that has been created by how you're supposed to look and how you're supposed to talk and what you're supposed to say.
Right.
And sort of original thought went out of it.
Right.
And I don't know exactly, I'm not smart enough to tell you exactly how television did it, but it definitely, and I work in television and I love television, I watch television, but it dumbed us down to an extent that we did not appreciate, have not appreciate, and do not appreciate now, because it's still having that effect. And I don't mean dumbed us down like we don't know who to vote for. I just mean we stopped thinking about important things. Maybe we stopped reading, but we stopped talking about things in important ways, and the debate became simple, and there was a lack of sophistication to it, and it created Rick Perry.
Yeah, no, and it got debased, but that's so interesting, Ben, because, you know, there's this new documentary that I don't know, I just watched recently. We've been mentioning it on the show probably way too much, but Hypernormalization by this documentary filmmaker for the BBC, Adam Curtis. And to make a very complicated documentary, which you should definitely check out if you haven't already, kind of long story short, he sort of says, and there's a version of what you're talking about, but he basically says, like, look, when you create that kind of homogeneity, and there's so much kind of inbuilt, you know, bullshit in the discourse that people can get, whether it's like, well, you know, we're completely running out of money and we need to implement this ruthless austerity, but then at the same time we need to, you know, recapitalize the banks and essentially have like this, you know, extensive new wealth transfer, you know, all of these sort of stories that don't really make sense delivered through these kind of mediocre vessels like you're talking about. And then all of a sudden Trump comes along and in this very crude and very, you know, brutish and dumb way calls it out, and there's an appeal to that. So it's kind of interesting. It's almost like you can transcend the Ben Nelsons by being like Jerry Brown, or you can descend and devolve and be Donald Trump. But either way, you're getting away from this thing that people seem like they're kind of sick of.
Yes, I think that's right, and that's exactly it. And there's a destroy the system quality to it, and it's edge to it rather. I think it was in The Nation. I hope it was a really interesting piece this week talking about Hunter Thompson and a piece he wrote for The Nation, one of the first breaks he got. And it became, I think, if I was reading it correctly, what turned into his book on Hell's Angels. And he is describing so stunningly accurately the Trump voter in the 1960s. He's like, we're not appreciating the degree to which these guys have seen tech. And he's talking about 1960s technology. Yeah. We keep making technological advances, and these guys know this doesn't help me. Right. None of these things are helping me. I can't put my finger on why, and I would have been. I'm not knocking them because I wouldn't have understood it either. You know, and I barely understand it now. But I know that this is not helping regular hardworking people who assumed that they were going to do better than their parents.
Right.
And he said at some point, some candidate's going to come along that is going to speak to these guys, and their reaction is going to be like the Hell's Angels. Let's just tear it down. There was a thought in the 60s that the Hell's Angels would naturally, because of who they were, would be part of the counterculture movement, right?
No.
The outspoken part of the civil rights movement. No. And what they were big pro law and order Nixon guys. And there was a sense among a lot of these people that, hey, I know something's broken. I don't like it. I'm being left out. And here I'm going to take the China, and I'm going to take a baseball bat. I'm going to take Negan's baseball bat. I've never seen Walking Dead, but I'm pretty sure that's the guy's name.
I haven't either. But I buy it.
And I'm
sounds
Jeffrey
right.
Dean Morgan is going to take it, and I'm going to smash the China, and then I don't know what I'm going to eat off tomorrow, but it's going to feel good to smash the China.
You know, the funny one of the most sort of like iconic videos I saw during the summer for me, which people were pointing out that it stripped away any vestige of like, you know, bikers as in any way, like in any type of counterculture. But there was this Bikers for Trump rally during the Cleveland convention, and the head biker basically had his squad go out and shake hands with all the cops and kind of thank them for being there. And, you know, maybe some of these guys will still get in a shootout with cops, you know, in Texas or something if you're busting up like a meth lab. But the basic attitude, but it is very subservient to authority. And yeah, and the Hell's Angels were known for like beating up hippies and all of that stuff. But that actually brings me to another question I want to run by you, Ben. And I think we're totally off topic, which is great because this is even more interesting. What would you say, though, because the other problem, and this to me, though, is where I get really hard on Hillary Clinton and the total failure of sort of modern, I really would hesitate to even call it liberalism, the third way corporate, you know, crap, basically, that when you decouple, when you had three different trends kind of powering the modern world, right, you had very kind of buy-in to right-wing economic orthodoxy, deregulation, slashing safety nets, and even like the debate between Clinton and Blair type people was like, we're going to basically follow, you know, very corporate-friendly, orthodox, neoliberal economics, and then we're going to create a couple of small social programs to equip a couple of talented people to basically rise above their circumstances. But the conversation totally shifted from just raise the overall baseline, right, which is like the traditional,
right,
you know, argument that people like you and I would make. Like, you shouldn't need to test exceptionally well to have healthcare and retirement. These are basic needs that everybody deserves, right? But So you had that one trend. Then you have technology, which you were pointing out with Hunter S. Thompson. And then you had this very, very important fight, which I think at times, you know, I think in the 90s, Bill Clinton certainly played some very questionable games with racial rhetoric at times and signed Defensive Marriage Act and everything else. But overall, there was clearly a right and a wrong side. And it was really clear during the Obama era where it was like, okay, there's progress somewhat on social issues, whether it's marriage equality, at least symbolically in terms of the makeup of leadership of America. And there's a right and wrong side to this. And then somehow what happened with the third way Democrats is they put themselves in a position where they conflated, you know, basically really bad economics for normal people, technology, which can be great, but it can also be very disruptive and needs to be, you know, managed and governed in certain ways. And then these really important fights for social emancipation, so that they kind of basically said, this is a package deal. And, you know, racism and bigotry and misogyny and everything else is a hard enough thing to overcome to begin with. But when you start positioning it as, you know, again, it's a package deal. You support, you know, racial equality and trade agreements that suck and your job being replaced by an app because you can't separate the three things. That's a pretty dangerous message to take to most of America.
Yeah, and I mean, look, I'll defend them slightly by I don't think it was the message they intended to take.
Sure.
I think that, and you know, I believe that they thought NAFTA would help people, mm-hmm. right? Or would help people in addition to who they knew it was going to help.
But it's even way bigger than NAFTA, you know what I mean? It's a whole set of deregulation and everything else, you know? And in a sense, like, their intentions don't even matter. You know, it's like the policy played out the way it played out, right?
That's right. But the policy played out the way it played out. That's right. So right, and I don't think intent matters. So I think what you're definitely getting is a total lack of, here, I'll sound like many on the left who I don't think have a firm grasp of American politics, many on the far left. I mean, we're on the left, but we've been outflanked.
I don't appreciate that.
Right. I know, man. Yeah. I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm super liberal. What happened?
Yeah.
The establishment, the Democratic establishment did not understand that. They haven't, and they still aren't showing that they quite understand it, but we're early and you got to give them 4 or 5 months here to coalesce, I suppose, or at least I am. But they didn't get who was carrying that message and how strong that message was. That's clear. And much of this, of course, is, as I started this conversation, or part of it was talking about television and how it created a world of people who look like Roy Blunt and Ben Nelson. I don't think they understood the country we were in, how powerful that message had been, and how to counter it effectively. You know, they just thought, as simple as we have a very well-known person who's had a very distinguished career, and we have a president who's pretty popular. Mm-hmm. Great. Well, we got it. This is easy. So whether she, 3 million votes aside, what seemingly gets left out of this, that she's now going to basically have exactly the same number of votes that Barack Obama got in 2012, is that 7.5 million new people voted in 2016, mm-hmm. and none of them voted for Hillary.
Right.
Right. That's one that would be a way to look at it. She got zero of those votes.
Right.
And, 3 million of them went to Trump and 4.5 million went to other people. And then you lost. And that's that. So they didn't see what was out. They didn't see that mood that you had, which, again, may not be able to be specifically defined by voters. But like we talked about regarding Thompson in the 1960s, just a sense of nope. This isn't working. This isn't working. This isn't working. And I don't trust you. My trust in all of you people has completely evaporated. And we have to find a way to get that message out, because we believe that if that message is carried by the right person, that it will be a powerful message, that there would have been people who felt alienated and left out and wanted to take a sledgehammer. But if they'd heard that message from someone, from a progressive, would have thought, who didn't have the baggage that she carried, they would have thought, okay, all right, good. This guy understands me.
And by the way, I mean, I did a segment, I don't know if you saw it, but there was a New York Times piece after the election, a couple days after it, which I thought was way more relevant than trying to figure out. Because look, I think there are a handful of Trump voters that genuinely fall into this category, and they could have been persuaded on economics, and they even could have been persuaded maybe even just on a kind of personal feeling. And I think that that's honestly some of these people anecdotally who are very low information. They liked Obama and they liked Trump, and that was it. But I think the vast majority of Trump voters were A, they were Republicans voting for a Republican nominee, or B, let's be real, there was a lot of bigotry there. And I think it's very foolish when some people on the left want to kind of deny that. But there were these African-American voters in Milwaukee who didn't vote. And they basically were just like, look, like, things are not going well the past, 7 or 8 years. Like, the recovery is not great. And when you don't have, like, Obama's charisma or symbolism, combine that with voter suppression, which they also mentioned, and my busy, hellish life, and just in terms of sheer work hours, I might not be able to go out and vote. And I think, like, that's actually the people, when you start to decouple that, when you say, like, hey, we're the party that wants to break up the monopolies and have your consumer good prices go down, and we're opposed to racism.
Right.
There's a pretty compelling message there. It's not a package deal. They need to be decoupled.
Yes, they need to be decoupled, and we need to have somebody who can carry that message. And the way to do it, I mean, this is crazy. The way to carry that message is to mean it,
yep,
right?
Right.
Not just to have it be the message, but like, right, maybe just do it and then say you did it and say this is what you're in favor of, because you have a record that supports that. So I don't think it's that complicated. I think there are probably more people who voted for Trump that are capturable. I don't care about their, and I know you don't either, I don't care about their souls.
Right.
I care about their vote. Right. And, you know, and whatever, you probably and agree. I think, you know, I'm going to guess if whatever, 62 million people voted for this guy, that it's eight of them, 8 million, 7 million.
Yep.
But it's a significant number.
Yeah, that's a real number,
You get those and you win elections. But then we have a whole other problem because we got 33 states with, you know, with Republican governors, and we could name five of those Republican governors, please don't ask me to, who are not insane. Right? Who aren't reactionary right wingers. I won't use the
I could literally name one, actually. I think maybe Charlie Baker in Massachusetts. Maybe.
Yeah, okay. No, sure. Yeah. He would definitely be on the list. So, you know, it's tricky, man. This is far bigger than getting an appropriate presidential candidate to, next time come along and knock Trump out of office if we're lucky and win in a wave that turns the governorships from whatever it is, 34 or 35 Republicans to 32. And still massively, you know, reactionary right-wing state legislatures. I mean, that is a obvious failing. I don't know if it's Obama's failing, but it's certainly a failing of the party over the last 20 years, of which obviously he, you know, you can't really have that conversation without mentioning his name.
Go screw yourself, Ben. final question.
That was good.
Oh, you like that? I can't follow you. Yeah. All right. Well, look forward to more in the future, buddy. I got to figure out what I'm going to do with that impression now that he's gone. That's what I'm upset about. I wish he would stay in office and declare Sharia so I could keep doing that impression for another couple of years. But, you know, my last question is, again, with that sort of maybe slightly historical perspective, but the thing that it strikes me, and we were going to get to North Carolina, but we've talked about it a lot. The bottom line is that voter suppression, a presidential administration that obviously has no respect for any even sort of like pretending vestiges about institutional order. North Carolina Republicans have basically staged a legislative coup to strip the new governor of power because he's a Democrat over all sorts of vital things that implicate his ability to reverse the crazy agenda that he ran against in terms of discriminating against transgender people, in terms of his role with election, the courts, voter suppression, everything. And it's like and then it seems like some Democrats, like even Obama comes out in his press conference and is like, yeah, Russia hacked us. And, you know, it's not good. They're kind of they're bad guys. But, you know, don't worry about it. We'll figure it out. And, all right. And it almost seems like Democrats need to start becoming more disrespectful of institutions themselves in order to save them. And, you know, there's idea that Democrats used to be kind of more brass knuckles and, you know, maybe like in the Kennedy era or something. And like, where is that?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I mean, it's in Jerry Brown. It's in Bernie Sanders. These guys are both, you know, going to be 80 the next time we have a presidential election or shortly thereafter. I think Brown is old. Brown, by the way, in that clip you ran, it's interesting how much to me he sounds like Bernie Sanders.
Right.
You know. So it's a generation that was in politics or coming into politics when Democrats behaved that way. And, you know, and I give the need to restore dignity to that office and character is understandable. And we shouldn't dismiss that's what the current president wanted to do. But again, I would say they missed what was happening. You know, his first 5 years spent trying to get a deal with people who weren't going to make a deal, even a deal that favored them.
Never.
Like he
offered them horrible deals. We got saved from terrible things because they were too intransigent.
We got saved from terrible things by people who were so terrible they didn't even recognize how good the deal was for them.
Right.
He didn't get that. And Hillary didn't get that, except she would, I think, have been the Clintons liked to fight, and there was the benefit to that. And Obama doesn't like to fight. Yeah. And we need to recognize that it's okay to fight. And at some point you hope that we're going to sort of wake up to what the stakes are, and who our opponents are. And stop talking about, hey, can't we just come together? Stop talking about purple America and start talking about winning. And the way you win is you make this powerful case of what we need and what we can do and what we can provide. And, You know, real quick, I know we got to go. Yeah, but, Harvey Kay, the professor at University of Wisconsin, Green Bay.
Great guy.
Written a couple books on FBI, right? Have you had him on?
Yeah, he's been on the show, yep.
All right, well, good. Well, I'm interviewing him Wednesday, so that's why I'm just on the Young Turks. And,
oh, cool.
And yeah, I mean, we need that case made, because that case is going, I don't think we're wrong. That case is going to resonate with enough people to start winning. But that case has to be made, and that case has to be made with a degree of aggression and not some desire to co-sponsor a bill with people in the other party, because we think that's what people want. And if it is what people want, that is not benefiting and has not benefited the left. That has been a loser proposition for the left.
Here, last thing I'll say, two quick things, Ben. To mention my name during the Harvey Kay interview, obviously.
Sure.
Yeah, of course. Just basics here. And then number two, the Republicans are like the Medellin cartel and Escobar, and they were not defeated until the Cali cartel took them on. So the Democrats need to learn from the Cali cartel. That, I think, is the big lesson of Narcos.
That's the takeaway for the kids.
Yes. Be more like the Cali cartel. They're going to use that in ads against me when I run for office. All right, Ben. Thanks a million, as always, man. I really appreciate your time, and I'll talk with you soon, buddy.
Ready? All right, Michael.
All right, thanks, man. Welcome back to the Majority Report. That was Ben Mankiewicz, the great Ben Mankiewicz. We're going to get to the fun half. We have plenty of sound and stories breaking in this time during the story.
Just FYI, we got a bit of YouTube hiccup we're fixing through right now, so 1 second.
All right. Are we on?
Yeah,
we're on
audio.
You
can carry on.
Okay. In the time during that interview, or right before we went on air, Russia's ambassador to Turkey, Andrei Kavlov, was assassinated in Ankara. And what apparently the shooter shot him and said basically this is Aleppo revenge. Part of the reason I haven't gotten to Aleppo, honestly, is it's very hard to disentangle all of the various dynamics of it, other than the fact that it is obviously a horrific and terrifying humanitarian catastrophe. There's a contingent on the left that seems to really want to defend Assad. I find that extremely disturbing, intellectually vacuous. I think it's fine to point out hypocrisies in U.S. foreign policy and the many ways in which we support horrific human rights abuses, and the fact that even the Sunni groups, obviously on the other side of the divide in that conflict, have many problems, not least of which are obviously groups like al-Nusra, Jabhat al-Nusra, before we even get to ISIL. But as far as what we can establish through the United Nations, which is the only even remote hope of an objective monitor of the situation, is that a pretty depleted Assad Syrian army, with support from the Iranians, including and groups like Hezbollah, but also apparently Iranian military advisors on the ground, and the Russians, are going basically house by house in certain neighborhoods and murdering young men of fighting age and dislocating families. Now, they're attempting to negotiate evacuations and ceasefires, and certainly some of the Sunni groups have also disrupted that as well. But the point I would make is that there is no side here that you want to in any way justify or try to explain away. I understand, as an example, when Mosul is liberated from ISIL, we say, we got rid of these terrorists that were running the city. And then people say, well, wait a second, weren't terrorists running Aleppo? Well, maybe. But there also was obviously a lot of support in that population to some degree for the rebels. Now, ultimately, one of the reasons that Assad has never fallen is because there is real organic support inside Syria for the Assad government, in spite of its, you know, sort of unbelievable crimes and brutality. But there's unbelievable crimes and brutality on the other side as well. So that's where it stands, and it led to this apparent assassination of Russia's ambassador in Ankara. We have to get to the fun half. We'll talk about that more, as well as more news about Exxon, Russia, pipelines, European security infrastructure. We'll talk about some fun things, too. I promise. We do have some good sound for you. The IMs are on 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. If you're the first caller, you'll be that sacrifice. But we'll get to the rest of you. Join the Majority Report today. Independent media is more important than ever. We just saw those reporters schmoozing with Trump in Mar-a-Lago. So if you think that mainstream corporate media is going to hold to account the geyser of lies, corruption, extremism, brutality, fanaticism, and incompetence that is going to come out of this administration, then you are not an expert on American media or mainstream corporate media. Independent media needs your support. Majority.fm/become a member. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. Subscribe to us on iTunes if you don't already. Write us a review. Go to Majority Report Kickback for our YouTube, for links to our Amazon and Jet accounts. If you use those services, give us a little cut. And subscribe to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast and Ring of Fire. Everything else in the Majority.fm universe. See you in the fun half.